I said, you know, the volatility, obviously, the implied volatility today is a lot higher than it is on Monday because the jobs report comes out today. So that's something you can expect. So you can get you can buy a Monday, sell a Friday, which means you're covered as an option because you're long one and you're short one. So, you know, you can lose money on it for sure, but if you buy one and sell the other, you're considered covered if you buy one further out than the one you sold. Okay, so that's kind of basic margin for a retail account. And I said, you know, I'm a little bearish, actually. Maybe we should try like the 421s, I'm sorry, 521s, or the 520s, which would have been like four strikes down, which is, you know, it's pretty bearish. And he said, okay, why don't we kick it around in an hour or so? When it gets closer to the close, there's no reason to do it now. Well, the thing sells off, we close at like 513. So we'd have been bearish, and we'd have been eight strikes below our strike, which would have been not bearish enough, Kevin. So the Fed's Cash Carry came out and said there's a possibility, basically, of no rate drop this year, which I've been saying kind of all along. So is Dan thinking it's one maybe, and not three. I mean, it was supposed to be what, six originally, and then it was three, and now we're down to maybe one.
Now we're down to one, and only because we don't want to go to zero.
Yeah. So that's kind of where we're at, and of course the people from Goldman and everybody else come flying out afterward and say that's ridiculous. We're going to have these cuts, you know. So everybody hits the page, or the TV, and starts doing something, and then all of a sudden you got. L. Arian, who comes on once in a while, aren't as often as he says, the Fed has turned into a play-by-play commentator. Well, I mean, we've had, what, seven, eight, or nine Fed people in the last two or three days all talking and all saying something different. And every one of these speeches is tradable, Kevin. I say one thing about the labor numbers. Some people may already have them. I mean, I'm sure some people do, my view of the world. I was talking to my brother Dan last night. I said, out of all the numbers, you can give me the labor numbers, and I'll have them before everybody else. I'm not so sure I can trade on it because of people's interpretation of those things. But you give me a couple of Fed speeches, and I can trade ahead of that with probably a batting average of 800.
Yeah, well, see, what's going to happen as far as markets go, and boy, am I out over my skis when I start talking about markets, but... is everybody's going to react to the top line number, to the number that everybody reports. And then if you give it a day, people are going to start looking into the numbers and you're going to start seeing it settle towards everything that Carl's going to tell you 5 minutes after they go in.
Right. Yeah, and you'll hear nobody talks about the revisions, nobody talks. And I just, I don't know, I can't get a feel kind of for the labor market, Kevin. I know... my nephew's place in the manufacturing area has probably three, four openings, and they're having trouble finding people. Other areas, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's a skill set.
Are they openings? Are they replacement openings, or are they new?
One guy retired, I think, and a couple guys they hired to replace that they didn't work out, type of thing.
Okay, so they're replacing people. That's really what I'm getting at. They're not creating new jobs.
No. One might be new because they got a lot of business.
Okay.
They think they decided they needed an inspector full-time because they have so much business and that sort of thing.
Because they have so much business, or is that because they have so many mistakes that they have to correct?
They had a couple of mistakes that because they were busy, I think. Well, they like to think it's because they were busy. So they think it's better to have somebody there instead of having to do everything over again, which makes some sense.
Well, yeah, it's not adding value, but it's worse when things get out the door and they're wrong. So yeah, to that extent, it's important to have inspectors. But if you have to rely on inspectors, then you've got your own quality issues. It's an expensive way to do business. Let's put it that way.
Well, you mean as a Well, I go back, it's a long time ago, Kevin. I remember at Pullman, they would, as part of the engineering process, the engineer would also tell you essentially how key the part was and what the tolerance was and how often it needed to be checked. So that was part of the process. So they had internal people that, but it was never overwhelming to the guy who was actually doing the job. I mean, they would say this particular, this particular piece of the, say, the underbody might have been a piece of stainless or whatever it was. You know, and it might have been a whatever you want to call it, a right angle piece with some, you know, some holes drilled in it, and they would say it's, you know, 34 and a quarter inches plus or minus 10 thousandths or something, or plus or minus an eighth.
Yep.
And then they would say, you know, every 10 has to be inspected, or every 20. So you could tell if somebody was punching them out on the machine and all of a sudden the machine slipped or something.
If you are doing a random selection or a cut selection like that, all you're really going to prove is if there is something systematically wrong.
Right.
That you're doing it wrong all the time. And you'll catch that by doing it that way. What you won't catch is just having an error, a mistake rate that's too high. You might get a bunch of them, but you're really kind of relying on luck to hit the ones that were made bad because you just happened to catch the right.
Well, it depends kind of, depends sort of on the process. If you're talking about a big punch press, and every 10 or every 20, you're going to tell if somebody walked by with a sledgehammer and whacked one of the settings on the machine and now it's 32 inches.
Yeah, you're going to know if they're all wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
You're going to know if they're all wrong, but you're not. But if you're making 5% wrong, which would be an unacceptably high rate, you may or may not catch it. You'll probably stumble across some that you have to reject or scrap along the way, but you're not going to really understand your mistake rate if you're doing that. And if you have to inspect everyone, that's a really expensive way to do business.
Oh yeah.
But you may have to do that if you have a faulty process and you have to fix it. You have to figure out what's going on. Then you have to do inspection.
Well, once your machine setting goes,
if inspection is a step in your manufacturing process, you have a problem and you're too expensive.
But they would, it's more of a check of the machine settings every once in a while is really what it is, I think. That's the way they...
You can go checklist and be okay.
Yeah.
I mean, that's stuff that'll work for you.
Well, but one of them...
You're getting the idea, though.
Yeah.
What I'm trying to say is it is not how you want to do business.
No, I mean, the person who does the job should essentially be doing it right in the first place. I mean, you really can't have... I mean, when you built the Golden Gate Bridge and people are inside those towers... There wasn't room for two people to watch them, right?
Yeah.
You know, did you?
When I'm teaching my class, I tell them there's four words they have to know, four made-up words. Two of them that I've heard before, and then two of them that I made up. So the first one is called DURFT. The second one is called DURST. The third one is called TIASO, and the fourth one is RIFPOC. If you can remember those four, then you understand your quality. DURFT means do it right the first time. Durst means do it right the second time.
Yeah.
More expensive than the first. The third one is throw it away, start over. TIASO, throw it away, start over. And the fourth one is RIFPOC, return item from pissed off customer.
Yeah, well, that's...
That's the most expensive one.
That is the most expensive one. All right, so what do we got? What do we got going on tonight? You know, it's funny, I talked to individual people. Of course, I was talking to my brother Dan yesterday, who's the best. Has a totally different view of the world than me. Imagine that with brothers, right? And there's a guy in the local saloon, Tripoli Saloon, who pretty much is a, well, in his mind anyway, he's a super expert on all sports. And actually, that's what he does all day. He kind of quit his job, and you know, he pretty much is a walking encyclopedia and everybody in every place in sports. But it's interesting how people get a point of view on the NIL stuff. When I was talking about the other night with one of my attorney buddies, and this guy's view is, what are you talking about? Tom, it's absolutely the same as it's ever been. They always used to give people an envelope. It's just a little worse. And I'm thinking, we're not even on the same planet. With people flying back and forth every year and 10, 15 people at every school essentially handing out offers to people all day long. It's nowhere near giving somebody $100 in an envelope 40 years ago, I don't think. But, you know, I mean, in principle, I guess it's sort of the same, Kevin, but it's just not the same. And my brother Dan, he traded on the corn options for a long time, and before he became president of PTI, he traded on the CBOE too. So I mean, he's got a lot of experience. And he said, no, you got to look at these numbers, not like there's some sort of conspiracy, or not like they're totally wrong. They're just the numbers. I mean, people would come out with the grain estimates, and you knew the number was wrong, but you knew somebody had to do it. And the process was such and such that it was fairly even all the time. And people just interpret them the way they interpret them. And his idea is there's no communist plot here. There's no people actively lying. It's just people doing their job, and this is where it landed. And, you know, Kevin, I think that's really, really wrong. I mean, I'm not going to win the argument, right, because there's no winning on it. But I think it's totally wrong. I mean, I've been involved in this stuff. If you turn the bucket around on like the CPI numbers, I mean, a lot of money that people do, there's not as many, what do you want to call them, COLA clauses in contracts as there used to be. But there certainly is a COLA clause in the, well, I don't know if it's a clause, but there's COLA in Social Security. And it's around, and people will sign contracts. If it's a long-term contract, I have to assume that you know, there's some COLA clause in there. And if the numbers are wrong, you hurt people. And you always seem to hurt the same kind of people. I mean, if you turn around to the other side, and it's not like me getting a check, okay, it should be bigger if I'm working for someplace. I mean, at Pullman, you know, it was during the inflation era. Well, you know, the first inflation era in my lifetime. If the CPI went up 1%, in those 3 months of the quarter, we would call the MBTA, which we're making the cars for, or Amtrak, and say, inflation's up 3% this quarter. You know, our $100 million contract is now, you know, 103. And they'd say, okay, because there was an escalation clause in it. Well, I mean, right now I have to believe that if you and I, Kevin and Chief Construction, contracted with somebody 15 years ago to build them 10 houses a year in some, you know, some big subdivision that was going to grow over the next 15 years, and we built the same house, which would be pretty damn boring, but say we did, we gave somebody a price 15 years ago of, you know, we'll build it for $185,000. You know, the property's already there, blah blah blah, and they're going to sell it for 2.25 or something, which was probably the average price 15 years ago, and we have a cost of living clause in there, or basically an escalation clause based on the CPI. I have to believe we're out of business, Kevin. But there's no way that would come close to covering our costs today for the same house, would it?
Small problem, huh?
It's a small problem. So I mean, you can't just say, you know, the government's doing this and they're lagging and blah blah blah, and people don't interpret the numbers, and you know, I said, well, what about the healthcare? You know, it's 0.6% of the basket. It's 21% of the economy. Yeah, but if you're 25 years old, it's not 25% of your economy. But you can get there however which way you want, Kevin. But the fact is, they're wrong. I mean, and people,
well,
are, you know.
But we're also an age when we have so much. We have the technology to do this. So if that's your argument, then tell me what the inflation rate is for the average 50 or 55 year old, and then tell me again what the average inflation rate, or what the inflation rate is for the average 25 year old. That's okay. You want to have that discussion, let's have that discussion. But don't just dismiss everything because of that. Say, okay, let's dive into the numbers, because how many times have I said on this very show that all the data should be doing is leading you to your next question? And so, yeah, you want to make that observation? I'm cool with that. Let's have that discussion. But don't just stop it there. Well, yeah, it's not for the average 25-year-old. Fine. What is it for the average 25-year-old? Because I'm telling you, that you know, what we're seeing in data is that the average 25-year-old's pretty pissed off and is probably willing to pull the trigger for Trump, cast the vote for Trump than Biden, at least as it stands right now. So, you know, there's something not right about the economic data for them. It's showing up. It's showing up to the point where, you know, you have Democratic advisors saying, stop your voting drives for young people. They're going to vote for the other guy.
Well, I mean, I think if you flip it the other way, I'm going to say the 25-year-old versus the 70-year-old. 70-year-old, in most cases, probably has a house that they, you know, not everybody, but probably some in that group, have a house they bought 40 years ago, and it's all paid for.
Yeah, there's some accumulated wealth, and there's equity in the home at that point.
And maybe have a car to still run.
If we want to inflate those prices, you're killing the young people who want to get into the market for the first time, and you're helping the older people who eventually will sell.
Yeah, and you've got...
Or you're helping their estates, anyway.
When you've got young people buying their first car and buying their first house, got to be gagging, unless they're getting all money from pops or moms.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is I don't have a lot of patience for being, you know, for people who get dismissive about the numbers when it's there.
Yeah.
It's not hard to dig into them and figure out what's really going on then. So don't just tell me, yeah, but, and walk away. You know, okay, you made an argument. What's the number then? You tell me.
Well, I mean, some of the...
And if you don't have any math literacy, then shut the hell up.
Well, some of it is a dismissiveness that's born into every trader. I mean, I pretty much was guilty of it earlier in the show when I said, you know, I look at these labor numbers because we go through them on the show and they mean a lot to people, okay? And Carl is the best at it, I think, certainly that we know. And so I think it's, you know, it's very important for people to understand. But I'm going to say that to a trader, there's going to be a reaction to these numbers. You really don't know what the reaction is because we're still sort of in this good news is bad news, but maybe not sort of range. So they're not tradable. So to a trader, they're like, we'll just see what happens. What's the point of digging into them? That part I get from a trading mentality, but it still doesn't mean that, you know, somebody should be telling you everybody's getting hired when they're not, or nobody's getting hired when they are. I mean, there still should be some effort to do this. Hey, I want to
actually represent reality.
Yeah.
You know, hell no.
But I had a question with Russell the other day. We were talking about, you know, he's mentioned, you know, certain African Americans might be voting for Trump and younger people. And yet, this is weird. And because, I mean, I asked him flat out. I said, Russell, if I lobbed an economic... I said, we're all guilty of this to a certain extent. Because I know I am. And I'm somewhat conspiratorial and disbelieving. I'm getting that way. We're all guilty of this, that if it's something we sort of know about or can study, I mean, we're going to do a deep dive into these numbers today. We're going to match up the household survey with the establishment survey and find out if there's one works, one doesn't. We're going to look and see if the hourly wage is going up, and by the way, the paycheck might be going down or not going up means people are working. We're going to try and dig into all that stuff because, you know, that's what we do. this is what we're comfortable doing, a lot of the people on the show. But I said to Russell, how do you... You're taking this survey because people say it often enough on the air. If I were to go like that on an economic number, you're going to dig into whatever the show, you're going to find out I'm all messed up, and you're going to send me a text saying, what are you talking about? I said, but there is no survey group that we can do the same thing to. I mean, I could hear that African Americans are sliding the Trump 50 times on the air. And then the next day I could hear, you know, God knows who, Mormons are sliding to Biden 2 days later 50 times on the air. And I'm going to believe it, I guess, if I'm told it often enough. And yet I don't have any ability to say, where the hell did you get those numbers? What did your survey consist of? I don't know if it's any good or not. I mean, to be honest, maybe it is. Give somebody a break, but I wouldn't know how to do a survey today. Nobody's got a home phone. I mean, you can't just go on Michigan Avenue and ask people. You can't go in Inglewood and ask people. I mean, are these things any good, I guess? Or are they just giving you the result you want? They want.
Yes. That's what you're getting. I have no faith that it's not slanted.
But I would really have.
I have no faith. You know, I don't have any faith in the slant. We get gaslighted every day from everywhere. So I don't know why we would expect anything different.
If I was gonna look at African Americans, I mean, talk about a group where you can't just say African Americans. I mean, you have college professors like Eric. You've got the people that Audrey and I went and she had a show at the apartment. It was this black couple that live there. I think the guy might have played for Cleveland, Kevin. Big, huge dude. He's a golfer now. He's got to be 70-ish, but they obviously have money and investments and all kinds of stuff. Now, do I take those two interviews and then go to, you know, pull some guy over and grab him by the neck in Inglewood or the West Side? And does that equal three? I mean, there's a massive dispersion in African Americans.
What you get out of politicians often enough is they will talk about African Americans or talk about Hispanics or anybody as a homogeneous group, which they definitely aren't. There is black middle class. There is black upper class. There is black urban. There is black rural. All very different. And I think if you were to really, really try to understand, you know, population and demographics, you would probably find that middle class white and middle class black are pretty much the same. The same groups. All these different ones, and yet the politicians love to divide us and go along a different line. So that's part of the pathology that we have with our politics that is not healthy. But we'll talk about that because the concerns are the same. Where it's really when you're talking about why people are, you know, why political opinions, why the surveying at this point, the polling at this point is going the way it is, it's because you have an administration whose policies are specifically hurting the groups that have been their core constituency for a long time. So, for instance, if you look at immigration policies, they are hurting the urban black populations that have historically been solid Democratic voters. They're hurting them because they're sucking up resources in the cities, and they're sucking up, they're coming in and taking jobs at lower pay away from the lower to lower middle class. They're doing, all of those things. So that's got a disgruntled group that used to be a core constituency. You're also, with all the social stuff, the transgender,
I know what you're talking about.
People who do like female impersonations.
Oh, yeah.
So those stories. That you've got a Hispanic group, and the focus on abortion and abortion for, through all three trimesters. Well, you've got a Hispanic group that is very, very religious, very Catholic. And that's a problem for them. All of that's a problem for them. And this is why it's trending. It's not trending because everybody's looking at Donald Trump and saying, oh, God, his policies are so good for me. What they're really doing is they're looking at the current Democratic administration and saying, your policies are really, really bad for me.
Well, I think we're going to go to break, but I think we're in a situation where on the show, one thing we sort of all agree on is these policies. Put this way, it might not be the policy, but the trend is definitely in one direction in terms of where all the money's going, and it doesn't really matter who's in office. So the reaction is, who's ever in office, you throw them out every 4 years, which I don't know that that's whatever. S&P futures up 15, and in the first day we have 95,000 executive orders reversing what the other guy just did. I don't know if that's such good government, Kevin. S&P futures up 61. S&P futures up 15. NASDAQ futures up 62. Be right back.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to gauge the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other decision. And Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with relevant trade ideas, and equips you with cutting-edge tactics you don't already know. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on pursuing life, luxury, and happiness through sports, fitness, travel, food, spirits, music, and a whole lot more. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Stocks. jocks.
Sharks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here. Right now. Right here. Right now. Right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howell. Greg Pappas on the board, and I think everything's all fixed. We have Kevin O'Neill with us. S&P futures up 16, NASDAQ futures up 64. We're trying to bounce back from yesterday's pretty serious sell-off. I mean, where are we? We're Friday. On Tuesday, we had a sell-off, but we came back, about 40% on the close, Greg? So it wasn't it was a sell-off, but it was no fear. Now, yesterday, there was a little bit of fear.
Sneaky sell-off?
Yeah, well, yeah, it was a buy-the-dipper kind of day. You're happy you bought the dip and type of thing. Well, yesterday, if you bought the dip, you got run over. So yesterday was not a buy-the-dip. Maybe this morning is, but we'll see. Bonds are up 2 basis points, 4.33 there. The sneaky cause of the market getting weaker in the last week or so, I think. We've gone from like 4.1 to 4.3-something on the 10-year. The bond up 1 basis point, 2.637. And I might sound like a broken record here, but got to keep your eye on this 10-year, and that's just whether the Fed's going to drop the short-term one or two times, if at all. Because the 10-year is what you're going to price stuff on more than the other. We're in Europe. We've got the DAX down 256. That's 1.4%, so they're reacting to yesterday. FTSE down 77. That's a full percent. CAC around 113, another 1.4. So whack-whack over there. Asia, Nikkei down 781. That's 2%. 38,992, so kind of a ways back from the 40,000. Hang Seng down a buck, Chuck. So let's call that one flat. 16,723. Shanghai down 5. Shanghai is still closed for some reason. Hang Seng is open, but Shanghai has not traded since the 3rd, so they've been closed for a couple days. Again, yesterday we were... these numbers, the Dow is down 530, it's 1.3%. S&P down 64, 1.2%. NASDAQ down 228, 1.4. So all of them were buried more than, we don't usually give this number, but the VIX, Greg could talk about this if he wanted. VIX up another 22 this morning, 1657. We were talking last night with our group, Greg, a couple guys that went along the VIX and actually made some money. We have oil up 2 cents, 86.61. It keeps creeping. Obviously, crept more yesterday, 86.61. It's only up 2 cents today. Brent up 21 cents, over 90, 90.86. As high as it's been for a while. Natural gas, 179. RBOB unchanged, 279. And we have gold up 340, 23.11, down a little bit from its high. Plus silver's down 38 cents. Silver's been absolutely on a tear. Still over 26, 26.86. Last, we have the foreign exchange. The euro is 108, as like it has been. And the British pound is 126. British pound's actually a little weaker. The dollar's a little stronger against the pound. Greg, a lot of stuff there. What do you got for us, Traffic Weather Sports?
Morning, everyone. 6:38 here in Chicago. 38 degrees right now. Breezy today. Probably about a high of 44. Phoenix, 66 now. We got some clouds later. It'll probably stay around 66 there. Traffic inbound Kennedy from O'Hare is 14 minutes. Easy. Inbound Edens from Lake Cook, 28 minutes. Ike from Wolf, 22 minutes. Ryan from 95th is 17 minutes, and the Stevenson from 294 to the Ryan is 21 minutes. White Sox was a close one last night. That was 1-10. And we got the NCAA tomorrow. That's Purdue. No, NC State and Purdue. And Alabama UConn. That starts, the first game starts 5:09. And that's all I got, Chief.
We got the girls tonight, right?
I can.
Kevin will know. Kevin, girls are tonight, right?
Yes, they are.
I'm kind of anxious to watch them. Watch all both genders.
Yeah, girls are tonight. That's NC State tips off at 6 Central, and UConn, Iowa tips off at 8. Both on ESPN.
So the favorite's still in the first game, right?
South Carolina's the favorite.
Yeah, they haven't lost all year.
Yeah. And they haven't. They had a close call their last game, so that showed at least that they, people can play ball with them. And NC State, I've seen them live. They're a very good team. I don't think they're as good as South Carolina, but they are capable. And good team, well coached, tough team. So I would give them at least a puncher's chance here. And worth watching. Their best player, in my opinion, is a young woman named Sanaya Rivers. So, You can check her out.
Odds makers say that the UConn-Iowa is going to be a lot tighter game than NC State-South Carolina.
Yeah, and where you go there is the UConn-Iowa is the game with the stars in it. What you do is if you were to go back 4 years and look at the recruiting rankings, I sent this to Tom a couple days ago. Caitlin Clark was actually the number 4 rated recruit in her class. The number 1 was Paige Beckers, who plays for Connecticut. Beckers lost two full seasons to injuries. She is at full strength now for the first time in a long time, and she's really, really good. Number 2 was Angel Reese, who you all saw playing for LSU.
She's the one who was just going for the pros. She's got the modeling contract.
She is going to turn professional, yes. So Beckers is kind of going to come back for her extra year. Reese is leaving. The next one after that is Cameron Brink from Stanford. I don't know if anybody has seen Stanford play. They were a number 1 seed this year. Brink is about 6'4", 6'5", very tall, slender, blonde. If you've seen the highlights, you'd know who she is. Then Clark, and then number 5 is Camilla Cardozo, who is South Carolina's 6'7" center. So out of all of those are all really prominent names in the tournament.
So the recruiting work was sound.
The recruiting rankings were pretty sound. What's interesting is Cardozo actually went to Syracuse for a year and then left and went to South Carolina. She was a starter at Syracuse as a freshman. She went to South Carolina, and South Carolina was so talented and in fact had the number 1 draft pick last year, Aaliyah Boston, that she came off the bench for them, and this is her first year as a starter. She is also going to become a professional next season and should be a very, very high draft pick.
The source of that Reese girl, her NIL money, was it because she's like a model and stuff, and she's strikingly good looking?
Oh, yeah, she's very attractive. She's a different, I don't think she is any less competitive and any nastier on the court than Caitlin Clark is, but Clark really pulls it off well on the interview part. So, she comes off as just a nicer young woman. That may not be fair to Reese, I know what it's like. As you know, when I'm competing, or when I was competing, I can be the nicest guy in the world until I walk on the field, and then I'm kind of a jerk. So I can relate. When I was playing ball, if it came into my head, it came out of my mouth.
that happened to some of us. I was kind of the different, because of being the pitcher, people always, especially somehow or another, the north side people were mouthier than the south side people. I don't know why, Kevin. I always struck me that way. But the more they gave me crap, the more
they weren't any mouthier. You just couldn't understand the South Side people.
Maybe. But I just totally ignored them. So I think it pissed them off even more than if I reacted back. Go ahead and jaw the whole game. What do I care? I'm pitching. Try to get a hit. When you get a hit, then you can jaw. That type of thing. Anywho,
at any rate, if you're going to watch any game tonight, watch Connecticut, Iowa. That's got some genuine star power. It is definitely worth seeing.
Well, there's a boatload of contact and physical stuff going on in these girls' games. I mean, so I can see whether they're not, they can be pissed off. I mean, it's tough ball. I mean, because there are nobody. This is going to sound awful. You can't they can't jump like the guys can, so they're always up against each other. I mean, I think it's actually a little more physical in some ways.
In some ways, yeah, that's true. And that's really the difference in the game. And this is, why a lot of people say, well, I'm not interested. It's a different game. Your centers are 6'4" and 6'5" typically. That's a guard in men's basketball. And the explosiveness and speed is just a matter of physiology. You'll get some who are as fast as anybody, but by and large, you don't have people, flying through the air and dunking the ball and any of that kind of stuff. The physiology doesn't allow for it. Even if you're even if you're 6'4" and you're standing next to a man who's 6'4", and even if you weigh the same thing, the physiology is that, you know, the muscle mass is still 15 to 20% less. So it makes it a different game, and so it suffers by comparison. And you know, if you really want to enjoy the game, if you watch tonight and you want to enjoy the game, don't compare it to the men. Just take it for what it is. It, you know, they'd be better off in many ways if it were like the difference in college between college baseball and college softball. It's still a baseball style game when you watch a softball game, but it's a different game. And so nobody says, well, this isn't as good as baseball. It's different enough. You know, you can count on one hand the sports where it's played by both men and women, and the women's has comparable popularity. Golf, not quite, but there is a fair amount of popularity for women's golf. Tennis is really the one, and even that's different. It's three sets versus five. The power is different, and I think in some ways people like women's tennis more because they have longer volleys.
They also have nicer legs.
In any sport you look at it, and the women are in very, very fine condition. So, yeah, an attractive woman who works out all the time, that's probably draws some eyes to the sport.
There were some ladies on the trading floor that said they stopped watching men's basketball when the shorts got too long. So it's not just one way.
Yeah, well, you'll notice in women's basketball, the shorts are not long. Yes, they don't wear the long baggy ones.
Well, then there's beach volleyball, but we won't go there.
We won't go there.
But that's we have. When you're talking about the voting and what the population, you kind of vote your pocketbook and stuff. But I'm sure I don't know who the hell I'm going to vote for. I don't think I'm going to vote for either one of these two birds, but that doesn't leave me with much. Did you have any idea? Two things I want to ask you about. One is the Louisiana prop bet thing, but the other one is, does anybody know how many ballots RFK's likely to get on or is on already? I asked a couple people that question. Nobody seems to know.
Yeah, I don't know, and I haven't had time to look into the... Because you and I talked about this offline once. I haven't had time to look into the swing state ballot requirements. As I mentioned, there were, in some cases, you couldn't even get on a ballot without a running mate. So he just picked a running mate in the last week. So now he can start applying to get on ballots in some places. But there's like seven swing states, and really those are the only ones where he's going to have an impact on, or a potential impact on the election.
Well, I don't want to sound like actually really doesn't matter what your economic system is, socialism, communism, or allegedly capitalism. Your politics is really separate from that. Anybody who thinks for a second that this is a, quote, democracy, all you have to do is spend an hour one day and go through two or three states. I did this about 10 years ago and find out what it takes to get on a ballot. I mean, it's in some states you got a bunch of petitions just to get on to be a write-in, I think.
Oh, and you have a current administration that is working to keep people off of ballots.
Everybody does.
Yeah, I know, but you have a whole operation that is built around they don't want RFK Jr. on any ballots. They also don't want Cornell West. No, Cornell. What the hell's the guy's name? But there are some other people out there running who also can siphon away votes. So,
if you get somewhat of a summary, I'm going to say a half-assed summary, you can get a kind of a half-assed summary by looking at after the election, about 2 weeks later when everything settles, look at the vote totals by state. And you might say, why would anybody, why would that make a difference? You're going to find some states where it'll be, I'm assuming these guys will make it through the convention alive and everything else. It'll be just Trump-Biden, or Biden-Trump. I mean, that's it. And then you go to states like Colorado, I think is one of them. These are off the top of my head. And Michigan might be one. There'll be a list of like 20 people. And there'll be Kevin O'Neill with five votes listed. So obviously it's easier. I don't know if they were necessarily on the ballot, but clearly the write-in is easier to do or is there or something. But there'll be states that have 10, 12, 15 people listed. In other states, just two. So I have to assume in those states it's pretty hard to get at. Yeah. Just saying.
And it is Cornel West, and he's out there calling Biden a war criminal. So, but you know what? He's gonna pull away some of a handful of the radicals. And when you expect the races to be close, they're gonna do everything they can to keep him off the ballot.
Well, and I think the Trumpers, if there was some moderate Republican of any sort that was running, they'd be dying to keep him off the ballot.
Yeah, or if Nikki Haley decided to run with the No Labels Party, which is kaput right now, by the way. Of course they would, but the point is, that's not what's happening now. What's happening now is the challenges from the left.
Yeah,
and,
oh yeah.
And they will do damage to Biden. You know, I mean, you know, how much is it going to take to swing Wisconsin or to swing Michigan? It's not going to take much because they were close in the first place.
Anybody who thinks that the money or the political shenanigans is only the party that you don't like, I got news for you. they both do it absolutely up to their eyeballs, and the extent that they can cheat on the contributions, they both cheat. I mean, it's insanity, and it's totally. I don't see either one of these parties. I mean, Russell was talking about his sister being her wages sequestered because the evidently the place was not considered a non-essential something, and they got some of his EDP money, wherever it was. Might not have been the PPP. It was one of the two, and now they're going after her. Some of the guys that I know here that are attorneys are defending people who evidently lied on applications but never got a dime. Now, okay, you shouldn't lie on an application. I get it. But why don't we worry about the people who did get the money? I mean, we only have a certain amount of law enforcement. You know, it's like, do we really want to put out parking tickets when there's guys going 120 miles an hour down the Ryan? I guess the answer is yes. So, I mean, I don't see either party turning any of the wrongs I see in this society around. I don't think it's even anywhere near on their agenda. We're not going to get any kind of truth in economic numbers. We're not going to get... We're just going to maybe shift a little bit who gets the first check, unfortunately. Anyway, but Kevin, what's the scoop on the prop bets in Louisiana?
Well, they have legislation that is saying, I think it's starting August 1st, that you can't do prop bets on that deal with any college athletes.
So explain what a prop bet is.
Prop bets are like how many points is Tom Howe going to score in this basketball game? Anything like that. I think you'll probably see a lot more of that coming along. And you know, Lou had an interesting point about it being limited to college where they can do that. But even there, you might they don't get a cut of it. But when in the NBA, or you know, you can pick any sport, when they've negotiated deals now with all these betting outfits, and that goes into the base for the that they use to calculate the salary cap, there will be some argument, whether it will be successful or not, that's saying if you limit the prop bets, then you are limiting the athlete's ability to make money. You're putting a constraint.
So what?
Well, yeah, Tom, I understand that. But from a league, you're saying so what? From a fan standpoint, Lou was discussing it from a legal standpoint. There is what, and there's, you know, you deal with what's right, what do we want, what's legal. Legal and ethical are two different things all too often.
Well, one thing that Lou and I, we have, you know, a couple of disagreements, not very many. And usually he's right in the sense that it probably is legal or something. I don't. He's a. How can I say this properly without insulting my buddy Lou, which I don't want to. He genuflects to the altar of collective bargaining agreements. And I don't know that because there's somewhat of an agreement. I mean, the idea that a collective bargaining agreement between the busboys at McDonald's, or busboys wherever they are, the dishwashers at McDonald's. You're going up against a monopoly. That is not an arm's length deal. You might have an agreement, okay, but it's probably not a fair one. It's maybe a little better. Same way with football. The idea that the people who are currently playing can cut a deal for the people who are going to be playing. Say that we'll continue to make what we're making, but it's okay. We'll only pay the first year guys all the rice they can eat when they're not even at the table. I guess that's a collective bargaining agreement, but it's not one that I would ever bless. You know,
well, I understand, but you know, isn't that what any union does?
Right, but I'm saying if a union decides that they can rob anybody walking through the parking lot, I don't know that supersedes state law, does it? I mean, loose point.
Is that really a legit example, Tom?
Well, but I'm saying the idea that you tell Kevin O'Neill that by the way, some of his the money that the team gets is based on their cut of the gambling, which I don't quite get how that works, to be honest with you. And all of a sudden, the next day...
No, it's not based on the cut of the gambling time. It is based on the overall revenue that the teams make.
Okay.
And then the salary cap is a percentage of that.
Okay, I get that part. But what I'm saying is that in one of the ways that the revenue comes in, be it illegal parking, be it illegal gambling, legal gambling, whatever, you don't have a right to that because of the agreement is what I'm saying. It's either legal or it's illegal or immoral or moral. You know what I'm saying? I don't see how if the NBA has 15 instances of guys shaving on his prop bets. Now these, for those that don't get what we're talking about, these are not over under bets on the Bears. They're over under bets on the halfback or the quarterback, which is a whole different world of policing, I think.
Yeah.
And if all of a sudden some state says, look, we're just not going to do that, there's been 15 instances in the last month where guys are being crooks here, I don't know that the collective bargaining agreement supersedes that. Obviously, they weren't able to police it, or it wouldn't have happened.
And I think Lou was pretty clear, Tom, that he didn't know that argument would prevail.
Yeah.
It was just that argument's going to be made.
Well, I don't know. I don't understand how anybody...
You can decide it's ridiculous. You can decide it doesn't apply. I don't know. I'd really have to give it more thought.
I didn't say I'd win the argument.
I've given it a moment's thought since yesterday morning. So.
Well, I didn't say I'd win the argument. Did I? I never do.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is the whole idea, anybody to think that prop bets on individuals isn't a bucket of stew in the first place, I mean, why wouldn't you? Right?
You go bucket of stew, I go can of worms. Either way, it's not a good thing. It undermines the competitiveness of the sport. It is an opportunity, an irresistible opportunity, and you know, in the context that it even came up at all yesterday. Well, partly because I sent both of you a message with it, but in addition to that. You were talking about it in terms of the Ohtani story and what's going on with that. Once you get that ability to corrupt and somebody is corrupted, you're kind of screwed because the integrity of the game, just the idea that if you're watching a sporting event, the basic premise of it is that it's on the up and up. People, umpire, you know, officials, people may make mistakes, they may do things wrong, they may, but there is nothing in there that is specifically rigged. If you lose that premise, you kind of don't have a product anymore. Let me put it this way, your product is pro wrestling.
Well, right, but I mean, we got to go to a car horn and very quick, but I'm going to give you an example from... I won't say back in my day, back in your day, Kevin, even though you're not as old. You're one of your heroes, Paul Bear Bryant, was playing. He's the coach of Alabama, legendary coach. And they were like 20-point favorites or something, some high number. And they're winning by like 18. And there's the clock is ticking down. They're on the other guy's like 30-yard line. In comes the field goal kicker. They kick the field goal. So they win by 21 or whatever it was. The question after the game, Coach Bryant, what'd you kick the field goal for? You're already up by 18. He goes, I know a lot of Alabama people bet on the game. I knew the point spread was 20, so I kicked the field goal. That was 30 years ago, Kevin.
Taking care of his peeps.
It's not like And I think most of the time for a game, it's pretty straight. I mean, pretty much all. Whenever you get these wide variances, I'm not so sure it's straight. But clearly, if it's a 2-point game, your coach isn't going to lose the game on purpose. I don't think anybody. I don't think anybody accuses anybody of that. But if the spread's 22, and that's why the gamblers are all over those kind of bets. If all of a sudden some big money comes in one side or the other,
basically you're talking about, you know, are we point shaving, point padding? Right. What are we doing there?
Yeah. We're not throwing the game.
But you can't shave points when you're an underdog.
Right.
It's not point shaving when you're an underdog, because then you're actually precluding winning the game.
Right. Well, I get it. What I'm saying is now all of a sudden in this new world, everything's clean. That you're going to bet, you can bet on a guy striking out twice, and if the game is, if his team's winning 15-1, of course he can strike out twice. What's the difference? I mean, the more you go down this road, the more you can't assume innocence, is my point, I guess.
Yeah, and so, you know, I don't know what you do about it. I'd have to give that some thought and come up with kind of a policy, because, you know, people are allowed. Once you make betting legal, people are allowed to bet on all kinds of crap.
Well, maybe there should be a limit to that. I don't know. We'll see.
Maybe so.
But then again, if you're dumb enough...
But then they're just going to go do it with the bookies anyway, so...
Well...
So you have sort of this...
All right,
throw up your hands and say, what in the hell am I supposed to do anyway? Well, all right, you guys go. I've got to head to the...
I will
be listening on the road.
Carl has all these solutions. We'll just ask him. SP Futures up 19.
Our live Sherpa.
NASDAQ up 7. We want to go right to Carl. Greg, you want to do some commercial. What do I do? You're the producer.
Do one commercial and come back to Carl.
There you go. He split the thing. One commercial and back. Splitting the baby, our producer, Greg Pappas. Be right there.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right here, right now. Right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howell. Greg Pappas on the board. SP Futures up almost 20, exactly 20. NASDAQ Futures up 7-8. We're trying to come back from yesterday. A guy like Carl always gets some satisfaction. Every time you go in there, you throw somebody some money, they throw you a beer. That's satisfaction. What do you think, Carl? Is Carl there? Doesn't sound like he is.
No, I guess not.
Well, we'll have to drag him in. He was there earlier, right?
He's here. He's somewhere.
He's somewhere. Buried in the board. Remember the Star Trek episode when the thing was going to crash and Scotty put everybody into the transporter and they left them there for like 200 years and they went and found them and they were in the transporter? Is that where Carl is? In the transporter?
He's in the ether.
He's in the
I
ether.
I see him, but I don't hear him.
Maybe he's muting himself. Carl, unmute thyself. Anyway, the numbers are coming out today and the labor, and I have I've already got my stuff up here, and let me say, I think the expectations are a little less than last month. I will do that in a second here for everybody. Dig up the economic calendar, and this, you know, of course, these things, you know, who are these expectators?
Here we go.
There you go, bud. We got you.
The vagaries of Zoom playing games with my configuration. It's don't know quite why it decided to do that, but that's it is.
But
what
you're
it
here
is.
Now. Everything's taken care of now.
I'm here now, and now it is working the way it's supposed to. Yeah.
What do you make of the? Well, a little bit of what we're talking about with the sports gambling. What do you make of that? I mean, is this too much too soon? I mean, it's one thing to bet on a close game. It's quite another to bet on somebody whether how many times he strikes out, and all of a sudden the game's out of reach and nobody cares. I mean, the people. If I was playing, I wouldn't want to know what the thing was, but that would be me. But I guess conspiratorially, I don't think players are betting on themselves. I think maybe they're getting trouble someplace else and they're getting leaned on.
No, they're not betting on themselves. But, when was the last time that you saw a system that couldn't be corrupted and didn't have people handing envelopes full of $100 bills under the table to someone?
Well, but why all of a sudden with this legalized gambling if people decided that all of a sudden everybody's honest?
They're not. Chief,
obviously.
Obviously not, right. I mean, you look at what just came out just the other day, and the drug companies tried to keep this data secret for 75 years. Okay? They lost. They got sued. They tried to keep it secret for 75 years. This is proprietary information. By God, you cannot have it. They lost. What the data showed was that the hazard ratio for a pregnant woman taking COVID shots was 4 times the placebo.
Wow.
Now, the study was underpowered, okay, because they weren't looking for that. That wasn't what they were trying to find, right? They were looking for, does it stop you from getting COVID? So that was not the endpoint that they were trying to measure. And as a result, the sample size was too small for that to be statistically valid. In other words, if you just use basic statistics, that data was statistically not significant.
Was it too small or not random enough?
Well, no, it was too small. The sample was too small. Okay, because when they did these trials, they didn't intentionally include pregnant women in the trials.
Ah, okay.
Okay, so as a result, you had this subset of people who took the shots during the trials, who most of them unknowingly were pregnant, but some of them were, okay. And so, there was this subtable in the data. Well, Pfizer did not want this out and tried to prevent this data, along with a bunch of other things from the trial data, from being disclosed for 75 years. Well, now, as it turns out, the data says that it's 4 times more likely to screw your kid. Now, it's not statistically significant because the sample's too small. But if you saw that data and you were an honest person, wouldn't the very first thing you'd do be to run a much larger trial with a with a statistically valid sample to try to figure out, hey, wait a minute, is there a signal in here or is this statistical noise? You'd think, right? Of course, that wasn't done. So, this kind of cheating goes on everywhere. And why do we do it? Why? Well, there wasn't tens of billions of reasons to cheat, was there?
Well, yeah. But
Chief, it's the same thing, okay? Well, I mean, you
I
know,
just,
so I'm...
I was just
so
going to say that one of the themes of the show is everything is the same as the other stuff.
I look at this and I say, well... Do people believe and I'm like, well, I look at the situation that we have in the world today. You say, well, this guy, we have a prop bet here that this guy is going to score. He's a kicker, and he's going to get 4 field goals by over under. 4 field goals in this net, in this next game. Okay, so his team is ahead by 30 points,
yeah,
right?
Right?
It's the fourth quarter, and oh, by the way, the safe thing to do, he's got 45 seconds on the clock. The safe thing to do is just down the ball 3 times, right?
Right,
because you're not going to other than fumbling the snap. there's no way that's going to turn into a, you know, a turnover and a touchdown for the other guy. But no. Here comes the kicker, and he's got to put one through. That is blatantly out of line, and yet that's exact. I mean, is it? Does he know? Does that guy? Does that kicker know that this
kicker
is
may not? Maybe the coach does.
Well, maybe the coach does. Maybe doesn't. You know. I mean, but the thing is, does who knows on the field or in the back office or whatever? Where the balance is on the book in these kinds of how do you prove somebody does? All right, I mean, obviously after the fact, you look at that, and you go, hey, wait a minute, you know. But there's no sanction, and you know, rigging contests like this is supposed to be illegal, right?
Well, again, this is a. Our view of human beings, and it's changed. I mean, I didn't watch any. I guess if I watched in the 50s, it was the late 50s. I was a little kid, but I was a Bear fan in the 60s. I was a big Bear fan. I could still name you the starting lineup for the 63 team, for God's sake. You know, 10 and 11 year olds are. They're crazed for this stuff. They would have. You could not. I think the word was consorting with a gambler. You could not walk through. They weren't worried about you betting on the game. They were worried about people having a string into you. Gee, Carl's into, you know, I'm not going to say seed. He's into the bookie for 50 grand, and oh, by the way, if he throws this game, he's clean. You know, they'll forget it. They'll forget half it. That's what they're worried about. They're not. I don't think they're worried about you necessarily betting on yourself or not. I mean, right. But so the idea was, I don't think when they suspended Paul Hornung and Alex Karras and who the hell were the baseball guys, that they got them put any bets down, and they might have, it was a long time ago. I think they were just seen with gamblers, you know, and were and having a drink in the club car with them or something. I mean, it was all about that. But you mentioned with the COVID situation and the drug companies. I'm sure you have noticed, because you're on all this, like white on rice. When, you know, even the old TV shows, the most respected man in the neighborhood was the doctor. He was not only probably the most educated, except for maybe a lawyer or somebody, but he I don't know how many MBAs they had in those days, but he was a very respected guy, and generally was considered to have amazing moral fiber, okay? Where you would never expect him to charge you $10 for a penicillin shot you didn't need. I mean, the thought would never even cross anybody's mind. What are you? You're in church with a guy on Sunday, for God's sake. But now these guys are not in charge. These groups that they're in, they tell you the medicine to. If you have high blood pressure, they'll tell you the one that they are pushing, and it may.
Here's part of the problem. Okay, I mean the process has become corrupt.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
All right. I mean, you have to remember that when the thalidomide thing happened. It was one person at the FDA who saw something in the data and blocked it from coming in here into the United States for use in pregnant women. And Europe did not do that. And as a result, there were only a handful of thalidomide babies born in the U.S., a very few. Over in Europe, it was a disaster. And we used to have, you know, it's the same sort of thing. We used to have a culture, even as recently as 9/11. Okay, we had a culture where that big red button is there on the wall. I mean, if you hit it and you're wrong, you're in a lot of trouble. But
yeah.
But it's there and you can press it. Okay, and on 9/11, there was one guy who saw what was going on. Within the FAA, within the traffic control infrastructure, he hit the big red button and he shut the airspace down in the United States. And what most people do not know, and there's never, you know, the funny thing is there's never been any real discussion about this in the mainstream media, and I don't understand why not. Well, actually, I do understand why not. I have a little inside baseball on that, and I can't prove it, because I can't divulge a source, but there were several other planes with hijackers on them that did not get off the ground at the time they were supposed to leave because there was a weather problem within the system. So there was a whole bunch of flights that were delayed that morning in other parts of the country.
There were more than 20 people involved.
That's right. And that ground stop probably prevented another 5 or 6 impacts.
How could those guys get caught and tried and everything when nobody knows about it?
They didn't get caught. That was the thing. Bush let all these people leave, including the people that were running the safe house down in Sarasota. They were Saudis. He let them leave on private airplanes while our airspace was locked down. That's a documented fact.
Well, you know, it was one of the unsung heroes of the whole mess was the guy who saw the first building having trouble and shut down all the subways coming into below World Trade Center.
There were a couple of people that, you know, that saw something that, you know, they're like, that's wrong, and hit the red button, right? But the guy that ground stopped, I don't think they ever identified who it actually was, but within the FAA air controller infrastructure, there is the capacity to do this, and this guy did it. And of course, if he'd been wrong, it would have been his butt. Okay.
Well,
but he wasn't.
He wasn't wrong.
Well, after the second aircraft went into the Trade Center, it was obvious he wasn't wrong.
Right.
Okay. But that was the, you know, that was that gut feel kind of, hey, wait a minute, this is not an accident. Something's going on here. We're shutting it all down. We'll sort out the mess later. And he did it. Same thing happened with thalidomide. We used to have a culture in this country where that kind of thing happened. Now, you look at what's going on with the border right now. When this whole thing started, do we have the ability to put a hard stop on this? You bet we do.
How?
We have laws that have been around since...
but I mean, what are we going to do? Have a million people in armed guards on a 1,000-mile border?
No, Chief. 8 U.S.C. 1324 says if you aid, abet, or in any other way enable this kind of behavior, it's a felony and you do 10 years in prison. You arrest a handful of people for doing that within these NGOs and within the United States that are providing aid, shelter, comfort, whatever have you. You throw them in jail and all of this stuff stops in a day.
Well, 20 years ago, every member of every country club in the country and every big restaurant would now be in jail.
Well, all I'm saying is you only had to, all you have to do. And it's, you know, we've talked about this a bunch of times, all right? I don't care how rich you are. The more wealthy you are, the greater the threat of going to prison.
Oh, without a doubt.
Actually is, because the disruption in your lifestyle is larger, okay? The bum who's living on the street, he may actually get a standard of living increase.
Remember your hero, what he said, Mike Tyson.
Well, I'm just saying.
What'd he say?
Who?
Mike Tyson when he went back to jail. Three hats and a cot. What's the problem?
There you go, right? But I mean, for the person who has absolutely nothing, that's actually
not
a penalty.
Well, we've talked. Let's shift gears a hair on this. Then we've got to start talking about labor numbers. I got my thing already up here loaded. It's loaded. It's one thing scarcely a day doesn't go by that somewhat one of the guests we touch on this, you know, prosecutorial discretion. I mean, obviously Russell was talking about it because they're coming after his sister from the paycheck she got during the COVID when she didn't do anything except deliver stuff to hospitals. And like I said, some of my guys are defending people on PPP because they evidently put in loan applications that were wrong but never got a dime. They were rejected, and yet everybody would think, well, let's waste our time on the people that maybe got money that shouldn't have and didn't give it back. But go back to the COVID stuff. It's not just, I happen to know, and I'm not going to reveal any names or anything, sort of like you, that the doctors in Illinois got a letter saying if they were seen like on TV or any place saying that these policies were wrong, they were going to lose their license.
Right.
Now, on one hand, I don't expect somebody to all of a sudden run out with a sandwich sign down the street, but how is it that somebody somewhere didn't get a copy of that letter and have it be on front page of the of one of the competing newspapers that are no longer around, like the Daily News or the Chicago American, and have the, because some of this, if that was published, even the people who were, you know, government does no wrong or whatever, you look at that and they're going to go, that's not right. But
well, Chief, look at what got caught when the shots started rolling out. Anthem got caught bribing physicians.
But it never, there was never an official.
But it was in the media.
I know, but it's not the same. There, you know, the media, we're getting good at this. When I say we, collectively, if it's a horrible piece of news for yourself, it goes out on Friday night during the NCAA
right.
game. I mean, I'm saying it's not the same as a letter on the front page of a paper with a letterhead of somebody in government saying, "I'm going to withdraw your license if you disagree with me."
Well,
I mean, I'm saying what I'm trying to say without disagreeing is there's levels to this. I mean, you can shoot people all over the damn place, but if you walk down the street and shoot a baby at noon on State Street, maybe that it's still one life. You know what I'm saying? There's news and then there's news. The other stuff, even though you're right, it came out and it was published. You had to kind of look for it. It was in the middle of a huge newspaper. I keep saying it, a huge mess of crap on the internet. You really had to focus on it. If you didn't turn to a show like this, and there's a lot of them where somebody talks about it, you'd never have it explained to you because it's like taking a drink out of a fire hydrant. You can't do it. But I'm saying when you have a specific document that came from a state agency with somebody's name on it, that to me is a lot different. Now, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm showing old school here or something, but I'm just saying.
Well, you'd think that would be a tremendous, you know, sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you'd think that would be all over the place. I mean, you really would. You'd think it would just be a good God. I mean, you'd think it would be everywhere. And oh, by the way, anyone who thinks that you know, that's you know, that kind of thing never happened, is because there are reports all over from people that have the receipts where, yeah, that was real. That kind of, those threats really were made. And you know, but was it ever in the front page of the Tribune?
No.
Was it ever in the front page of the Washington Post or the Washington Times or
by the way, are we allowed to say if we were on national TV that, by the way, this thing came out of the Wuhan lab, or are we still denying that?
Well, not only that. By the way, if you know, this the new scare is avian flu, right? Okay.
Yeah.
You do realize that it has been documented and admitted and funded by our Congress, including Tom Massey, who's been screaming about it now. Oh, gee, how come it's still going on? That the Chinese and the Americans have been corroborating on making H5N1, the specific strain that is now the latest scare fest, more transmissible and more infective and dangerous in mammals, meaning humans.
Well, why would anybody be doing that?
Didn't we learn anything from doing it with the coronavirus?
So they're doing experiments to try and figure out a way to cure it, and by that they're making it stronger. That's essentially what they did with the COVID, right?
Well, no, they're trying to try to cure it. You got to be joking. That's not the intent. The intent is, let's accelerate things a little bit to see what would happen if nature was to do this kind of thing. So we'll do it. We'll do it and see it. You know, it'll be totally safe. It'll never get out.
That's such insanity. I can't go there.
Well, that's what happened the last time,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Well,
all right. So here's the thing. Why isn't this sort of thing? Why don't you get literally dragged out of your office into the middle of the National Mall and hanged at high noon for running that sort of crap?
I don't think anybody. Some levels of government seem totally unencumbered by any discipline whatsoever.
Well, it's you know, the thing is, it's not just government. There's of course, you know, the Chinese were certainly involved in this. Okay, but we have. If you wanted to make an example out of people and you want to stop this kind of crap, there were plenty of people here in the United States, including Barrick, including a handful of others, including a major university in the U.S. that were involved in this with COVID.
Wasn't it? Was Carolina, wasn't it?
Yep, and they were in it up to their necks, and not a single person has been prosecuted for any of this. How many people are dead?
Well, yeah, I mean, look at the presidential choices, and you know, this is not. I'm sure anybody who gets to that level has to have some. I mean, I'm even going to say Trump has one hell of a skill set. I mean, it's not a skill set. He has other things that I despise, but he has. You can't say a man doesn't have a skill set, or you wouldn't be president, for God's sake, or had been. But I look at this. I mean, who's going to stop the stuff that we talk about on the show all the time? We're going to talk about this prosecutorial discretion. We're going to talk about companies, no antitrust anywhere, any place, any time.
Right.
Well, now you're going to have one guy gets back in who's kind of proven that he's not about to go after any of this stuff, being Biden. Right. And the other guy has proven that even though he may want to, or I'm not so sure he even does, but if he did, he's too inept to get enough people around him in Washington. They're going to put up a big wall all over the place, and he's not going to be able to get to anybody because he can't get anybody along with him. So either way, it seems like we're going nowhere for the next 4 years, in my opinion. I hope I'm wrong, but...
Well, no, we're gonna. There's an asset crash that's coming, and it's impending right now. And you know, that little blip you saw yesterday, it was the first little bit of recognition that, oh, by the way, we're not going to get saved by the Fed throwing more gasoline on a raging bonfire.
Well, you know, it's funny, Carl. You're you have that. You weren't a professional trader, but I was. But still, I mean, you know this stuff. A few people, even Audrey, who's on Sunday, or on Monday, my significant other, she was a trader for a long time, and she's still a licensed person here at PTI. Audrey has a pretty good sense of the world, and she goes, all the stuff you're talking about, you've been early, you're getting close. she goes, there's a tone change in the air, and if you don't sense it, there's something wrong with you. This is Audrey.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Oh, no. I mean, I see it around here just in the local, you know, the tenor of the people in the, you know, in the local establishments and stuff. And you know, the insanity that you know, is still going on in the property market because I, you know, I pay attention. I live here.
Yeah.
There's a huge tone shift. And, you know, that comes first. Okay. And then the recognition comes, and then the bankruptcies.
Right.
And the thing is, as I've pointed out, you cannot have, you know, anyone that thinks that a 5% 13-week bill rate is high for if you have 2% inflation and about 3% GDP, you're out of your mind. That's absolutely bog standard normal and has been for 100 years. So there's nothing high about that sort of thing. Now, what is crazy is that the TNX, the longer term bond is trading a full, you know, full point under that.
That's the part
that's
that
crazy.
Nobody seems to look at. If that thing goes to 7, we got a problem, or 6 or 5. But
well, anybody that thinks that it's not going to be higher than 5.3, yes, it is.
or the other one has to come. Something has
but,
to give.
But the other one can't come down when you're running a 30% structural deficit, Chief.
It can't.
It's not going to. And ISM prices paid is going up at a higher, at a faster rate again. It's accelerating. That was just out, you know, in the last few days. That's what I've been saying, is that when you look at the PPI data, you look at the incoming data on the cost side.
Okay? But we had to break it. I'll say just real quick. I've had, you know, some traffic in the last couple of months on bigger clients, and even some smaller institutions have called, and we've talked about the markets and so forth, that they're just basically, you know, I use the term balls out long everywhere, you know, because that's been the deal forever. And they're sensing they don't want to be that necessarily going forward. But the idea that, well, if it's not me talking, if that's the way you feel, we better do something like this week. Oh, I think we're good till the election or something. I mean, if you feel that way, I didn't call you up and say you should be worried about your stocks. You called me and told me you're worried about your stocks. And all I did was kind of parrot back to you, well, if you're worried, these are the things maybe we can do to take care of the risk a little bit, a lot, totally, you know, whatever you want to do. I mean, for God's sake, you go all the cash and put it in T-bills if you want it. But I don't necessarily recommend that. But I'm saying the idea when you do what I do is to take the sense of the client and put it into action. and yet there's no, you know, urgency whatsoever. I got a year to change my mind, to figure this out. Maybe you do, maybe you don't. You're the one that's worried, not me.
Everyone thinks you have a year right up until you have about 5 seconds.
Yeah. Well, it's going to break earlier, Carl, because the numbers will be out, and then we'll be the first on our block to assess them. We'll be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to factor in the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other life decision. Your brain is smarter than your gut, and that's why you owe it to yourself to read Luckbox. We've made it easy because Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with timely, actionable trading ideas, and equips you with savvy investing tactics you don't already know, all while exploring how to live your best life through music, spirits, food, sports, travel, fitness, and a whole lot more. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on controlling their financial futures. It's for overachievers and alpha types who don't buy into Wall Street's investment gurus. It's for mavericks who believe in life, luxury, and the pursuit of happiness. It's for you! Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck, get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right here, right now.
Right now. Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm talking about Greg Pappas on the board. We're going to do real quick here. The numbers have come out and we're flying all over the place. S&P futures are up 7, NASDAQ futures are up 23. First they ducked negative, now they've come back positive, and we're rallying some. Why don't you give us a real quick traffic, weather, and sports, and then we'll get right back to Carl, Greg.
Morning, everyone. It is 7:31. It's about 39 degrees here in Chicago. Breezy today, high of 44 today. Phoenix, 66 degrees. We got same temperature, more clouds later there. Traffic, inbound Kennedy from O'Hare is 21 minutes. Edens from Lake Cook is 40 minutes. Eisenhower from Wolf, 26 minutes. The Ryan from 95th is 24 minutes. And the Stevenson from 294 to the Ryan is now 28 minutes. MLB, we got the White Sox losing to KC. That was 1-10. Tonight, women's Final Four. That's at 6 o'clock. NC State versus South Carolina. And UConn versus Iowa. That's 8 p.m. And in the men, tomorrow, we've got the Final Four. NC State, again, Purdue. NC State Purdue at 5 and Alabama UConn at 7:49. That's all I got, guys. Back to you.
So we got the gross number here is what, 303 versus 200, Carl?
Yeah. So the household unadjusted is plus 1.041.
A million?
Okay, now that's not a bad number, right? It's in line with what you expect for a March, though. It's not hot. It's roughly average over the last few years. So March is usually on the unadjusted households is usually a good number, and it was. But
why
not,
is that? Do you think? Just
it's just the seasonality of things. Construction starts to come in. You start to see. There's a fairly decent amount of outdoor involved. Work that takes place during the months that are not frozen, and March is when it begins. So I mean, it's not, you know, it's there's an ebb and a flow to things. You know, January is usually a firing month, a bad one, right? Because it's all the part-time help for Christmas. Although depending on where the sample week is, sometimes it shows up in December as well. But December, January are usually punky, to be polite. And it's not at all. I mean, if you don't get negative numbers there, there's something unusual. And again, in the unadjusted, and we had two very bad. I mean, between the two, it was 2.5 million. Okay, so I mean, that's between December and January. 2.5 million. Well, okay, so we're plus 1.041. The other thing that's kind of interesting is that. We had about 500,000 people, again, unadjusted, come off the couch.
The adjusted is like three.
Well, so the here's the thing is that the so about half of that 1.041 was not new entrants. It was people that stopped couch surfing. So that's kind of an interesting thing. On an annualized basis, however, that couch surfing number is up 435. So that's a, you know, if you look at it as a 12-month trend, which is probably a more accurate way to do it because you don't have to worry about seasonal, you know, knob twisting, right? I mean, you just look at, you know, compared against last year, plus 435, which is not, you know, which is not a good thing. And the adjusted for population change, which is one of the, that's kind of the, that's the key number from my point of view, right? Is you take the 12-month run rate of employment change versus the 12-month run rate of population change of working age population, right? I mean, if you want to, you want a single number that gives you how's the economy doing from a standpoint of everybody in the workforce, it would be that one. That's 997, which is neg 997. That's not good, and that, by the way, has been deeply negative since December. So that's 4 months. All of which have been negative, well, neg 1265, neg 620, and two neg 997s in a row.
The I look at the, because I'm not on the same chart he is, but the adjusted numbers. And just as a way to basically look at the four of them, there's about five numbers in the bottom line that you sort of need to know. Actually, there's one, two, three, yeah, five numbers where you have a population of people over the age of 16. It used to be 14, right? Well, now it's over the age of 16 that are available, that are not in jail. They're not institutionalized, right?
Right, 16 plus, right.
Right.
Well, not in jail, not in a nursing home.
Right.
Right.
Or
so, yeah. Non-institutional population is the definition.
Right, so then out of that, there's people that are in the labor group and people that are, I will say on the couch, but could be students, could be retired, could be whatever. So out of the labor group, which is 167,895, 161,466 are employed with one job or more, and that's the trick
right
here, one job or more. There's 6.4 million that are in the labor force, don't currently have a job, and are looking for work. That's that definition, correct?
Right.
And then there is 99,989 in the last column, that we don't know what they're doing. I mean, somebody might know what they're doing, but they're could be retired, could be students, could be sitting on the sofa, could be whatever. I mean, I would say a lot of them are probably students, and a lot of them are probably retired. So the interplay of those numbers is what we're always talking about every month. And the weird part to me here, Kyle, is I don't see the labor force total. I'm going to go off the end of 2023. I could go from last March, but we've got roughly 700,000 more people in the labor force, according to this. Now, the adjustment should fall out after 14 months, one would think. We've got 300,000 more people work, make that 400,000 more people employed. We've got actually 400,000 people more unemployed looking for work. And we've got almost the exact same number in the back column, maybe 100,000 more. So, over the numbers aren't horrible, but they don't seem to match up with the absolute glee every month of 250 to 300,000 you get out of the establishment survey. Now,
they don't. But the other thing, so I'm also looking at the hourly and weekly earnings numbers. That's another thing that I always, you know, I always check at.
Carl, what was the revision? Did you catch the revisions? I did not.
No, I did not. I mean, I'll find it, but I, you know.
Well, aren't most of them been down, which is makes the number suspect to start with.
No, really? Oh, you mean accidents are supposed to be normally distributed?
Well, what we're talking about is they'll say the number is 300,000, and oh, by the way, February was 200,000, but the revision is like down 50 or up 50. And it seems like there's a string of downs.
Well, it doesn't seem like.
Well, there's been a string of downs.
They're right. And by the way, that's not just a Biden thing. That seems to be, you know. There's obviously, anybody who has any kind of knowledge of statistics at all that sees that says there's knob twisting going on. All right? I mean, that's the instant reaction you get to that if you have any sort of statistical honesty about you. The thing that I'm seeing, though, which is a little bit of a problem here, is that in the weekly checks, and it's concentrated in certain areas. It's not across the board. In hourly earnings and weekly checks, I see a decent amount of wage push inflationary pressure in the system, and it's being reacted to with hour cuts. And it's not everywhere, because if you look at the total private, it's a 7 cent per hour increase, and all of about $5 a week in, you know, in checks. That's not much, right?
Right.
I mean, at $1,000, that's not much. So, you know, that's a 0.5%. I mean, now again, over 12 months, you know, that's a 6% increase, right? So, I mean, that's not, you know, a little bit better than that, actually. Well,
that allows the Janet Yellens of the world to say, don't worry about inflation because your wages are going up faster than their view of inflation.
Well, except that if you look in some of the subgroups within there, you're seeing... So one of the interesting things is in mining and logging... You saw a roughly 34 cent per hour decrease in hourly compensation. That's not a good thing.
How could somebody go down?
Well, I'm just telling you what the data says. Okay, 36.55 to 36.21. That would get my attention if I got a pay cut of a quarter an hour, right?
Yeah. Well, I can't believe there was a cost of living adjustment that went backwards.
Well, neither would I, right? But, you know, I'm just telling you what the data says. But then I'm also seeing some other things that are interesting, too. In some of the manufacturing areas and non-durable goods, the hourly compensation was completely flat. And yet hourly checks were up a little bit, which basically means, you know, you got a little bit more hours, right? I mean, if you've got flat hourly compensation, but the check goes up, that means you're working more hours. On the other hand, durable goods saw, you know, fairly substantial increases on both sides, both on the hourly pay and on the weekly earnings. Other services, on the other hand, saw negs on both sides, 27 to 26.83, and down about $3 a week, well, two and a half in check size. So, yeah. Now other services is kind of that's the catch-all basket. The other one that I pay a fair amount of attention to is the lower end stuff, which is leisure and hospitality and other services are the two, you know, bottom end entries on that table, other than retail trade, which is, I mean, you know, this is people who are working in stores. But I see reactionary changes in here, but they're small. They're not big yet. But that's what this table tells me, is that there is a problem here in terms of cost push. I mean, on month over month changes of, you know, 15, 20 cents an hour, those are pretty substantial. And in information, it was 32 cents an hour in hourly compensation. That's a big move for 1 month.
And that was up, right?
Up, yeah. Right. And I mean, and these are, you know, so I mean, people say that there's no, you know, there's no cost push inflation. Boy, I want some of what you're smoking, because I sure see it in this table.
Depends on how you define it.
Okay, but I'll tell you what. It's very spotty, because here's the thing. In transportation and warehousing, hourly pay was down.
I'm going to, can I give you a 2 minute chief definition of the only time in my lifetime I've actually seen cost push inflation?
Well, you're talking about the old Carter times, eh?
Well, what happened, I think, if you, I've been consistent, and I think to a large extent, even though I love ruffling with you, we agree on just about all the real numbers that come out, even though you like looking at one page, I look at the other. That's good discussion. Back in the day, when everybody, you know, people talk about the labor unions and the cost push inflation, they were right, I think, for about a 6 month period, maybe a year. Carl, here's where I'm coming from on this. When you talk about a lot of the unions in their bargaining, finally got cost of living increases, and some of them were one for one. And right. Some weren't. Some were 75%, some were 80. Because we had a couple different unions at Pullman. I think one was 80, somebody might have been 100, whatever. Inflation really started in about 68.
Oh, yeah. No, I know.
Yeah, and so the idea that unions immediately got all this stuff, that's total BS. It took a while. I mean, your contract didn't come up in March of 68 the first time you noticed it, right? So whenever right. this came up, so this went on all kind of through the 70s. And as the 70s went by, then you had a couple of oil shocks, everything else made the regular inflation even worse. So as time went by, unions gathered this cost of living stuff. And it was in every contract. It was in the contracts that we had, when I say we, at Pullman, had with the Boston, with the Amtrak. It was in all any new contract that was in there. And it was all just a case of piggy move up. If there was inflation, you got more from the person who was buying it. And by the way, then you ran down and you gave all the other people their push up. Well, to be nice, I'll say that I learned early on that even if it's legit, your CPI number for some reason is pretty lagging. And I don't know why that is. But say
it's obviously going to lag.
You would think that if you and I's job was to go out and get the price of rice literally 2 weeks ago, that it would be lagging 2 weeks. It wouldn't be like 4 to 6 months. But somehow or another.
But it does.
It does. And I can't figure out how. I'm not in the building. I don't know how the hell they do it. But
I know part of how it happens.
Okay.
They don't look at actual ticket. They look at shelf price. So when you and I've seen this here locally, and I've seen it all over the country in other parts. So especially in things like groceries, okay. The ticket price and the price on the shelf are frequently different because I've got a coupon or I got a discount or whatever, right?
Okay.
So I got a coupon that says that the ground beef is $2.99 a pound, but the ticket on the tag on the shelf says $3.99.
Okay. Well, what I'm saying is,
but I'm saying they don't take the data out of the register tape.
Okay.
Okay. The final price out of the register tape. That's not where the CPI data comes from.
All right. Well, however it happens, it appears to me, and I think you're agreeing, it's 4 to 6 to 8 months behind. And why it is, I mean, anyway. So what happened in those days, for a short period of time, I think the inflation actually had stopped. I mean, Dr. Jay and I used to ride in the morning together and say, John, you come out with this inflation report, I don't see anything going up. Sort of like 3 years ago, when the inflation said there wasn't any, we go, everything's going up, right? I mean, it was like the flip side of that coin. So in this meantime, the labor unions and, you know, whoever was doing it still got their raises, even though McDonald's could no longer raise the price. So for that period of time, you did have to raise prices to accommodate the raise you just had to give people that maybe wasn't deserved, for lack of a better term. But I'm saying right now, there's no way that these people are not ahead. I say these people, the Home Depots, that the merchants are not ahead of any of these labor increases. They still are. Not every single firm, mind you.
I get that, but careful with that, because if I take the 12-month, and this is, again, off table B9, if I take the 12-month change from this last month and extrapolate it, it says that labor costs are going up at 8.7% annualized.
Okay.
Now, that's labor costs.
Now, does that include the benefits?
Well, no, that's right. Weekly hours and payrolls. Okay, so this does not include benefit costs. It does not include the other embedded stuff that's in there. Okay, so tax exposure, health insurance, things like this, right? But that's just direct, you know, direct payrolls. I'll tell you right now, if you think that you're going to have a roughly 9% compensation cost increase over the next 12 months and not see that end up back in the cost of things that come out the other end on the register tape for the consumer, you're out of your mind.
I cannot argue that with you, except for it's almost sort of the same thing as back then, because nobody's gotten the 40% raise that they should have since March of 2020. Now, in the next year, are they going to catch up and put some problems on the store owners and whatever next year? Probably. But, I mean, I took the idea of the Thai restaurant I go to, and Audrey and I go to, and, you know, all of a sudden the rate of the dinners went, and they don't gouge you. So they went from, you know, $12 to, say, $16 or something. They're still, you know, they're really good chow, so it's not like it's nuts in today's world. Okay, now the cook does, you know, what, 30 an hour, maybe, if he's good, 25 at least. All right, so that's, he's up 100, and they offered the guy a $5 raise.
Right.
So in terms of, what I'm saying is I think the Home Depots of the world and the McDonald's of the world are way ahead of today on anything that they've paid anybody. Now, are the labor going to catch up some the next year? Maybe. And will that put a squeeze on what McDonald's thinks they should be making? Maybe. But I'm going to say, Carl, at the end of next year, at virtually every place, if you look at what their prices are versus March of 2020 and what they're paying people, I don't think you're going to see people with a 40% raise. And I think a lot of people have got 40% increases in price.
No, and the thing is that the problem you have, which is embedded into the system right now, and I don't see how we get out of this without an asset price crash.
Well, I'm with you. I hope not. I
don't see how we get out of it. Is that we've had this 30-year trend of ever decreasing rates, which has incentivized people to roll over all of their debt into lower cost stuff. That trend ended. Okay, and it's now in the rearview mirror. Everybody is expecting it to come back. There's no way it's going to, because it also got into the view of our lawmakers in Congress, and therefore they're doing the same sort of thing. They haven't gotten the memo because nobody is, that kind of thing will never happen. But in the corporate world, the corporations never pay off their debt either. They always roll it. And, oh, by the way, the average tenor out in the paper in the corporate world runs about 7 years, roughly the same place it does with mortgages, right?
Right.
Well, guess what? Those rolls are going to start. They're already beginning, but they're very small right now. So you're
talking about people who essentially got loans at 3. No, you and I didn't, but Amazon did. Got a 3% loan, and now they're going to have to pay 6.
Oh no, they got a sub 2.
Okay, well,
some cases. Okay, but not anymore.
No, not anymore.
Because I can get 5.25% in treasuries in 13-week bills. So I'm not going to give them a 2% piece of paper. That's not going to happen.
Well, Dan keeps talking about how they, even the lower-rated bonds, think they're going to get like 6.5%. And he goes, no, I don't want anybody doing
stuff. It's going to be 11.
Yeah, he goes, right. Nobody's doing that if you get 5.5% in a treasury.
Well, exactly. I mean, I can sit in, you know, in the IRX, a money market that is 100% in short-term paper, and have, you know, 5.25%. They take, they take 10 basis points for managing it because it's computer, right? And I can take that all day long. I don't have to take any risk to do that. If the Treasury can't pay me, well, gee, I got bigger problems than money. So that's the world that we live in today. But you have all these people out there that think that the impact on corporate balance sheets and the earnings numbers is not going to be there with these rolls, and that is just lunacy. And this stuff over the next couple of years is going to really start to accelerate. You're going to get into the belly of this next year and the year following, and the market is supposed to be a forward-looking, you know, forecasting tool of sense, right? Well, right now, the market is saying that the 13-week bill is going to be at 2% before the end of the year. No, it's not.
No, I
don't care what happens. You're not going to see an IRX at 2% by December. That is not going to occur.
Well, it's even somewhere, and I don't know when or if somebody will write the pamphlet. Anybody write pamphlets anymore? And not the book, because it doesn't deserve a whole book. There's going to be some companies that financed at 2 and 3 that are now financing at 6.5, and their stock is going to be maybe down a little bit or maybe unchanged. And I'll just pick one here. Somebody's going to wonder why IBM, I don't know if they even did this, but why IBM bought their stock back at 200 when it's trading 120, and now they get all this debt on their balance sheet. Somebody's going to wonder why exactly the board and the people decided that was a good idea. We used to have a guest on the show that would trace this and said in the last 15 years, everybody thinks these corporate balance sheets are getting better and better. They're using all the money to buy stock back. Some of
well,
them are.
Well, by the way, you know, when you decrease the denominator, yes, it makes the EPS look better, right?
Right.
It also makes it makes the EPS larger. When there's a loss, it also makes the LPS larger by the exact same amount. And so, you know, anybody that thinks that when this worm turns, and when you have these companies that are, you know, have gone out there and put this paper out there, and essentially what they've done is take a levered bet on their stock price.
Well, sure.
I mean, that's essentially what that is. If you borrow and buy back your stock, that's what you did.
But it's not even, and I know you know this, it's not even going out and borrowing from you and me. It's like United, I don't know about American, United never buying an airplane. Everyone's lease. Well, the lease is the same thing as borrowing it for. So when you look at the 9/11 was what, 2001, right? I believe. And these companies went basically bankrupt. American didn't, but they got enough stuff where they were pretty messed up too. Now you fast forward to COVID in 2020, so you're talking about 19 years. In that period of time, the airlines had done better than they sort of ever had. And I think, Carol, I did this, you know, I take this one with a slight grain of salt. I think if you looked at virtually the entire United profits for that 19 years, they after being bankrupt the first time, I think a lot of it went to buying a stock back.
Yeah.
Instead of just saying, you know what, why don't we do something really stupid? This month, the plane's $300 million. Why don't we show up with a check and like buy a couple of them?
Yeah.
instead of buying the stock back. So if it ever happens again, instead of having a lease load on 500 planes, it'll be on, you know, 460. It'll at least be a little better or something. Nobody even, if you or I were to say that at the board, it would have been like we dropped a stink bomb, for God's sake.
Oh, my God, yeah. I mean, it's just, I see, when you look at the levered bets that people don't see as levered bets, right? I mean, you know, if I buy a futures contract, we all understand that's a levered bet.
Oh, yeah.
Right? The margin I have to put up is very small compared to the value of the contract. Right? So, I mean, that's a levered bet. If you buy a house, you put 20% down, that's a 5x levered bet.
Well, yeah.
That's what it is. All right? Well, all these corporations that have been doing this chicanery, borrowing to buy back stock, borrowing for operating, you know, for operating coin, at, you know, I mean, hey, if you can get it at 2%, this is fantastic. The problem is nobody looks at this when they do these transactions and says that paper has a 10-year term on it. When the 10 years is up, have we put a sinking fund together for the principal balance? And the answer is never yes.
Never yes.
Never.
No.
Well, is that answer.
We got a dash, Carl. Hey, on Monday, Greg, are you going to be let everybody know what you're doing on the website on Monday? You want to do it on a Tuesday? One day next week, Greg is putting together a really sharp trading website. We have some news on it. And it's not designed to give, you know, investment advice necessarily. It's if you like a stock, don't like a stock, like a future, don't like a future. And Carl, we'll have you review this if you don't mind. Essentially, sure. It says I'm bullish on XYZ. It'll give you like 10 option trades you could do that are bullish, and with the risk factors to all of them. And I think it's really neat. And
that'd be some neat stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And we're gonna it's not rolled out yet, right, Greg? It's still got a couple of wrinkles in it, but
yeah, we'll talk. It about
looks it looks pretty damn nice, to be honest with you. And we're gonna talk about it. So next week, Stocks and Jacks on Monday. We'll see everybody then. Have a nice weekend, and I hope we don't crash again today. Thank you, Carol. Back next week.
Anytime.
Stocks and Jocks is brought to you by PTI Securities and Futures. Go to ptisecurities.com. PTI ProDirect. Trade for as low as a penny per share and a dollar per option contract. Learn more at ptiprodirect.com. Nadex, offering an intuitive way to trade the financial markets. Visit nadex.com. HomeSource Realty. Call Audrey Johnson at 708-349-3456. Hamzy Analytics. Listen to Fari Hamzy every other Thursday and visit hamzyanalytics.com. ChiroMed. Back or neck pain? Schedule a complimentary consultation by calling 708-403-2727. DAX Research. Tune in for David Andelman's technical analysis on Mondays and Thursdays and call 1-800-821-4968.